Talk Show.
Recorded live.
All right, good deal. The start button responded instantaneously, didn't keep me waiting. I'm wondering whether it was going to work or not. And we're going to talk about Hebrews chapter 3. Again, this is Pastor Eli James with Yahweh's Covenant People. And we've been going through the writings of the Apostle Paul. And, you know, there are some people who don't want to acknowledge Paul as an apostle because there is no second witness, per se. At least, you know, I have to concede the point. I'm not aware of anybody else saying when Paul was blinded and had that vision that, you know, he was granted apostleship at that point. But certainly the apostles such as Peter, James, and John conceded that he was a great teacher and possibly their equal. And certainly Paul taught Peter certain lessons that Peter would not have understood without Paul. So lacking a second witness which says Paul is an apostle ordained by Yahshua Messiah himself, well, there isn't such. Yahshua never said that personally to him because Paul came later on the scene. But he certainly, by his own words, is a Benjamite, and whenever someone wants to disagree with someone's testimony, they can't just disagree and say, well, that's not true. You have to provide your own witnesses to say that isn't true. You know, it's not just enough to say that's not true. You have to prove it. And if someone makes a statement and you can't prove it wrong, it's the same principle applies. If you can't prove it wrong, then the statement stands until you prove it wrong. And so my position with regard to the writings of Paul is always, has always been that you cannot blame the author for the translations of his work. The first principle of scholarship is that you have to, you know, take the original writings. In this case, it's primarily Greek, the writings of Paul. And if you simply judge Paul by the English translation in the King James and never consult the Greek to see if there's any discrepancies, well, then you have done him a terrible disservice. And it's just like if I had written a book and every time I wrote the word white, someone who translated my work substituted the word black, you would totally get the wrong impression of what I had to say. And, you know, in the last few programs, especially in the book of Galatians, we have found out that the translations we are given have been tampered with. In many cases, the subject and object of sentences, their order has been reversed. And that reversal appears to have been deliberate from the Catholic Church. We know that the Jewish Masoretes tampered with the text as well, the Hebrew text. And, you know, there's all kinds of evidence, and even the Bible even prophesies in the Old Testament that there will be false priests who would be tampering with the prophecies and tampering with the scriptures, and that these false priests would gain a dominion over our people. And that's exactly what's happened. And I think to a large extent, the fact that the Holy Scriptures have been tampered with makes us study them even the harder to find out the nature of the tampering and what the motivation of the distorters is. And, you know, as we discover what their motivation is and how they have done these things, it gives us tremendous insights into their nature. Okay. And of course, I'm speaking of the Jews and their deluded followers, the Judeo-Christians, the Christian Zionists, et cetera, who simply hang on every word that's translated without having, you know, and despite the obvious contradictions in many, many statements, they never bother to look back to see, well, what does this say in the original language? And so you therefore must, absolutely must, consult the original language if there is a problem. And if there's no problem and nobody comes along and says there's a problem with this verse, it doesn't make sense or it contradicts another verse, then, okay, well, you know, you don't have to do a whole lot of digging, you know, but it doesn't hurt anything to go ahead and check things out occasionally. But when you do have a conflict, when you do have a contradiction, or when something just doesn't make sense, then you must go to the original Hebrew and the original Greek to clarify the issue. And this is what I have been doing in studying the scriptures, and I can say that in virtually every case where I've come across some sort of conflict, whether it's just in the translation or whether there's something that just doesn't make sense, consulting the original scriptures has given me tremendous insights and almost in every single case clarified the conflict. And so I would ask, Bill, you're with me, right?
Hello, Eli.
Yeah, hi. And so my guest today is William Fink. And I would imagine with you being conversant in Greek, you had a similar experience that when you confronted a verse in the King James or some other modern translation, that it was clarified by consulting the Greek. Not true?
Well, I decided to teach myself Greek when I found that Strong's Concordance was insufficient.
Uh-huh.
Even though it has a lot of useful features, don't get me wrong, it's a very important work.
Yes.
It's not sufficient for actually understanding the original Greek.
Right, right.
And okay. I decided, I was slowly pushed or impelled to actually sit down and get myself a grammar and a few lexicons and learn Greek.
Uh-huh, okay. And so, now in studying Greek, has it been your experience that in consulting the original Greek versus the translations, that, they've been of tremendous help in clearing up any problems?
Oh, absolutely. And I've written extensively on that.
Okay.
On that topic, I have a series of pamphlets translating John 1:11-13.
Okay.
Translating Luke, a few things in Luke 18 that are mistranslated.
Yes. Yes.
And I plan on continuing and publishing many more essays of that type.
Yes.
Which discuss major mistranslations and misunderstandings in the King James Version.
Right.
And
so,
all subsequent versions.
Okay, and I see that Pastor Greg has joined us. Ken, you there?
Yes, I love you.
Yeah, and I just asked, I pretty much described my personal discovery pattern of reading the Holy Scriptures and understanding that there are problems in the English translation. As a matter of fact, when I first published my book, The Great Impersonation, I gave a copy of it to an Orthodox Greek, Catholic, okay? They don't call themselves Catholic, but an Orthodox Greek Christian, and asked her to compare it to, the translations available to her. And I think she was reading Serbian, which I understand is very close to the Russian Orthodox. And she said, yeah, everything you've written is exactly like my translation, you know? So it's apparent that they have the same translational problems in their area that we have in ours. Now, isn't it true, Pastor Greg, that, we do run into contradictions, or at least apparent contradictions, in the English translations that just are confusing, and we really can't say that this is, the final word. We have to investigate these things, don't we?
Right, exactly. And that's why it's hard to discuss things with people that haven't went into research.
Right, right. Yeah, and doesn't the Holy Scripture say, search the Scriptures to find thyself or to deem thyself worthy? I forget the exact wording. I think that comes from Paul as well, that find yourself approved, to be approved.
Be diligent, or the King James translates it study, but it means be diligent to show thyself approved.
Right, right. And so that means you do more than just sit in the church on Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, whatever the case may be, and listen to a preacher who doesn't know much.
Well, I think it's Acts 17 or Acts 18. The men of Thessalonica, I believe, were a more noble race and searched the scriptures each Sabbath day to determine whether or not the things Paul was speaking was true.
Right,
that's
right.
The model.
Uh-huh.
That's the example.
Right.
Search the script. When somebody preaches to you, don't argue with them. Just go back and search the scriptures.
Right. Yeah, and I've found that, for example, that Paul quotes the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, constantly. You can't read virtually a chapter of any of his writings that don't have some sort of reference to the Old Testament. And so consequently, as we've been finding out, and especially in our discussion of Galatians and discussing the term circumcision and uncircumcision, what we're talking about in every case is Israelites. and not non-Israelites as the Judeo-Christian world would have us believe. Let me ask Pastor Greg. Now, when did you come to realize, or how did you come to realize that the English translations weren't sufficient and that you must go to the original language of the authors? Was that kind of a slow process for you, or did you grow up in this and know that ahead of time? How'd that help? How'd that happen?
Well, of course, I was raised Christian identity. My parents came to their knowledge in 1952. I was 4 years old. But in the 70s, under the studies of Buddy Tucker, he taught us that we needed to use the Strong's Concordance, research the meaning of the words.
Right.
And, of course, since then, you know, I've went a lot further than Strong's.
Right. Yeah, and you have to do that, too, because as Bill just said, there are problems with some of the definitions that are given in Strong's Concordance. And on Thursday's show, we talked about 2 Kings 16:6, in which the word Jew is used to translate the word Judah. And the Jews use the word Jew to mean all of Israel, meaning themselves. But in the 2 Kings 16:6, it only means the two-tribe house of Judah, and it excludes the 10 northern tribes of Israel. So, so there's a counterexample to the way they use the word. And so I would say, and let me get both of your comments on this, when the Strong's Concordance lists under the word Jew, or under the word Judah, which is the proper word, and at the last definition listed is Gentile. Under the word Gentile, the last definition of the word Gentile included therein is non-Jew. Do you think that that is an original part of the definition, or that was added by someone after Strong, or did Strong himself include them? Bill, let me address that to you first.
Well, in order to define a word, you have to find out how the native speakers of that language defined it.
Right.
You can't define gentilis. A Hebrew can't define the word gentilis.
Right.
A Roman has to define that word.
Right.
How was it used in the world at the time?
Mm-hmm.
As the Romans used it.
Yes.
And the same thing with the Greek word ethnos.
Right.
Now, aside from that, Strong and Thayer and all of the New Testament lexicographers, even though they were honest, forthright men who actually truly endeavored to produce the best work possible.
Right.
And I give these men a lot of credit, because writing books by hand, I've written books by hand, 600, 800 pages.
Right.
And it's hard.
That's right. It's a lot of work.
And these men, even though they made every earnest attempt to do as well as possible, they wrote their theology into their definitions.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
See it over and over again in Sayers and in everybody who followed.
Right, right. And any translator is actually involved in an editorial process, because it's very rare that you can translate from one language into another word for word, because words have more than one meaning. And consequently, it is an editorial process, and I agree with you. They did the best they could. So,
I give every effort in my translations to translate one English word for one Greek word, but it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in places I realized later that in some places my own translations fall a little short, because some words in one language, a word expresses an idea.
Yes.
And an idea in one culture and one civilization and one time and place.
Yes.
Cannot always be expressed by one word in another language, in another culture,
right,
another time and place.
Right. And even within the same culture, the word casket used to mean exclusively like a box sitting on your dresser. And only later did the word casket come to mean a box that human beings are put in and buried in. Okay?
Right.
So the meanings of words change over time, and you cannot assume that the English word Judeo, or the English word Jew, means the same as Judeos in the Greek or even Judah in the Hebrew. Okay? So let me address this question to Pastor Greg. You know, the first time you came across the definition of gentilis, or Gentile in Strong's Concordance, and you saw that definition at the end there that says non-Jew, were you a bit suspicious of that?
Well, yes, but I mean, you know, I guess I would spend 2 days researching one thing.
Right.
So, you know, I've always been such a truth seeker that I've got so many different books that I wouldn't just take one's opinion on anything. So.
Right. Right.
But, you know, it's like I mentioned last week about you can look up a word that's in the King James Bible, for example, under Strong's, to see what the meaning of that word is. But if you go back and that word was never there at all.
Right.
I mean, it's like right here in the.
Right. And certainly the word gentilis was never there.
Right.
It doesn't exist in the Greek or the Hebrew. So someone used it to convey an idea that none of the Bible authors ever intended. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like if everyone would just turn to Matthew chapter 20 and start in verse 22.
Okay.
For example, I'll read what was there, and I'm going to leave out everything that wasn't there.
Okay.
Of course, mine's going to read a little different anyway because it's scriptures. Mm-hmm. But Joshua answering said, "Do you not know what you ask? Are you able to drink the cup that I am able to drink?"
Mm-hmm.
They said to him, "We are able."
Okay.
He said to them, "Indeed, drink my cup.
Mm-hmm.
But to sit on my right and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those prepared by my Father."
Okay.
Now, do you notice all of those words? I mean, I'm not counting them, but there's probably 15, 20 words right there that was I didn't even read because they were never there.
Uh-huh. Okay, so they were added by the translators?
Right.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Right. And I've got a Bible soft program on my computer, and I look at the original on one side and the King James on the other side. And it's got the Hebrew word or Greek, whichever,
mm-hmm.
and then the meaning of the word, and then it's got a number, which is Strong's number, and you
right.
click on that number, and a window pops up and gives you the meaning of that word.
Right.
Well, here's all these words like those right there that have the word, the number 9999.
Okay. Which
and when you click on it, it says inserted word. This word was inserted by the translator
right.
for better readability. Well,
right.
when you got 15 words right in a row.
Right. Right, like the whole passage.
I would call that a lie.
Right, or possibly. Well, sometimes I agree with Bill that you have to give them the benefit of doubt that they weren't deliberately trying to deceive us. However, there's an editorial process by which their presuppositions determine what how they translate that verse. And if you have 15 words in a row that aren't in the original Greek, then there has to be a problem.
Well, there are...
Right.
Let Bill respond here, yeah.
15 words in a row, I'm not sure which... I'm sorry, I had a frog in my throat and tried to clear it, and I missed exactly which...
Matthew 20:20, did you say, Pastor Greg?
Yes.
Matthew 20:20. But this is the type. Yeah, this is the type of thing that we have to investigate. And I know every time, for people who aren't familiar with this, in your King James Version, when a word is put in italics, you know, when the rest of the type is in regular type, and you come across a word in italics, that means that that word is not in the original language, okay?
All right.
Yeah.
None of the italicized words are in the original language.
Okay.
But there are a lot of words they added that are not italicized.
Okay.
And
right. right.
You don't know them without the original text.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so consequently, anybody who says that the King James only, or the King James is the inerrant word of God, not
well,
knowing.
Can't discuss anything with a person.
Yeah,
like
yeah right.
They're already brainwashed.
Yeah, they're totally brainwashed. And what they're missing is that the original intent of the author is being kind of overwhelmed by interpretation here. Wouldn't you say that's true, Pastor Greg?
Yes.
Yeah, they're adding their interpretation, and it's almost an unavoidable process. As Bill said, when you're translating from one language to another, it's almost unavoidable to, you know, substitute words that, you know, don't mean exactly the same thing in the object language that they do in the original language. So for today, I've decided to forego the King James Version. I'm going to be quoting from the Moffat translation. And I found when I first started getting into Paul, and I ran into these apparent contradictions, okay, the apparent contradictions that seemed to, where Paul seemed to be denying the law, where he seemed to be an antinomian, where he seemed to be a universalist, I said, okay, I don't have, you know, I just finished writing my book, The Great Impersonation, and I said, I don't have time to get into, you know, diagnosing the Greek here, analyzing the Greek. I had already had sufficient experience in checking out the Hebrew for any problems in the Old Testament. I was fully confident that I would have the same experience in analyzing the Greek that would completely vindicate Paul, okay, that he was not a universalist, that he was not an antinomian. And ever since I started doing that, everything has been verified according to my presupposition based on my experience in dealing with the Hebrew words, okay? And this was just by studying concordances and in many cases studying commentaries by, you know, Greek experts and Hebrew experts, you know? And in many cases they will disagree on the interpretation, but at least you get a perspective on what the problem is, you know, and the fact that there is a problem. So here I'm going to be reading, and what I like about Moffat is that he reads much easier. It flows. It doesn't have the you know, stops and starts and the you know, the confusion of the King James. So I'm going to read verses 1-3 and give you a flavor of the Moffat translation. And probably most of you will have the King James in front of you.
And where are you at?
Hebrews chapter 3, verses 1-3. Okay. Holy brothers, okay, now he's addressing brothers, and of course the King James used the word brethren, you know, which is the archaic form, but it's still used today. Holy brothers, you who participate in a heavenly calling, look at Jesus then, at the apostle and the high priest of our confession. He is faithful to him who appointed him. For while Moses was faithful in every department of God's house, now, all of these faithful in every department of God's house in this translation is all italicized, that phrase I just used. Jesus has been adjudged greater glory than Moses, inasmuch as the founder of a house enjoys greater honor than the house itself. Let me just continue through verses 4 and 5 here. Every house is founded by someone, but God is the founder of all. Besides, while Moses was faithful in every department of God's house as an attendant, by way of witness to the coming revelation, Christ is faithful as a son over God's house. Now, to me, this reads very clearly, in spite of the fact that there's multiple clauses and subclauses and, you know, what do you call it, appositives, you know, that and it just reads clearer to me than the King James Version does, you know. And so if anybody's been following along and reading the King James, I realize right away that Moffat just has a better way of handling Paul and the New Testament in general. So, Bill, let me ask you, in verses 1 through 6, which I just quoted, have you run across any problems in the, you know, common modern translations that we should be aware of?
Well, I really don't read the common modern translations. I read the Greek.
Okay,
and I know the King James because that's what I studied when
right. Okay,
I first entered into this when I first started reading the Bible.
Right. Okay. Well, in the notes you sent me, and I'm assuming in the dark black letters you've got the King James, right?
Yes.
And then underneath in the yellow highlighted you've got your translation, correct?
Well, no. In the dark black letters that are in blue.
Oh.
The blue background, that's okay. My translation.
Oh, okay.
And the yellow highlight, it says KJV.
Oh, okay. All right, so I had it backwards. Right. Okay. All right, so let's go to verse 1 with your translation. I'm going to read here first the King James. Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus. Now, this is what I want to get into, the high priest Yahshua's office as high priest, and the changeover ultimately from what we have today, which is a priesthood by seminarians who are taken out of the context of the Israelite family brethren, okay, and the Israelite community, and sent away to some seminary somewhere and brainwashed into teaching something totally different from what the Holy Scriptures say. And so your translation then is, from which holy brethren, partners of the heavenly calling, you should consider Yahshua the ambassador and high priest of our profession. So he's talking about the priesthood, right?
Oh, absolutely. Paul uses Hebrews. He's addressing people that are very adept in the learning of the Old Testament, and they know the function of the temple.
Okay.
The ritual sacrifices and the entire model is being taken. The schematic is being taken by Paul and transferred in explanation. Not
yes.
Paul. Not that Paul is actually effecting this.
Right.
In explanation, the schematic is being drawn out by Paul throughout the whole epistle to the Hebrews and transferred to Yahshua Christ.
Okay.
He's showing how the sin and the atonement for sin and the administration of the atonement for sin, which is the function of the priest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
It's the function of the priest to sprinkle the blood and show that the sins are forgiven in the Old Testament.
Right.
And
right.
He's showing how this is all transferred to Yahshua Christ.
Right, right.
That's the entire main function of the book of Hebrews.
Right.
The temple and the high priest, the earthly temple and the earthly high priest, the Levites, that's come to an end.
Right.
And we now have Yahshua Christ,
right,
who is the lamb, the sacrifice for our errors and the atonement. And he is the high priest.
Right, right. So, Pastor Greg, do you have the same understanding that Paul is trying to get across this notion that there has been a change in the administration of the law and in the, you know, and obviously Daniel 9:24-27 clearly say that when the Messiah comes, the sacrifices and oblations shall cease. Is it your understanding also that that's all that's ceased and the rest of the law still applies?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We no longer have to sacrifice animals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go to a priest. We go straight to the Father through the Messiah.
Okay.
Our Redeemer.
Right.
It's spelled out in Daniel chapter 9.
Okay. Have you got it there? You want to quote that directly so people know I'm not lying about this? And also Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 37, which we've quoted, in proof of this as well. Those two, that's a second witness in Jeremiah 31 that says, the law would be written in our hearts, not abolished, okay? And there's absolutely nothing in the Old Testament that says the law will be abolished, and there's nothing in the New Testament that says that either. It's been interpreted to say that, but there's nothing that says the law has been abolished, not even Colossians 2:14, which is like the main thrust of the antinomian argument, and they simply have translated that horribly and not understood it at all, that the Colossians 2:14 is talking about the writ, the indictment against us. That's what was nailed to the cross, not the law. Okay? And so when we're talking about the new priesthood, and if there's no, in fact, it calls into question what the priesthood is even for. If there's no law to administer, what's the priesthood supposed to do?
There is no priesthood in Christianity.
Okay.
We are all priests. We're a king.
Right. We're king priests. Yes.
What does a priest do? He administers the will of the God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is the original idea of a priest, is to administer the will and the rituals and the functions
right.
which God requires.
Right, and for us that's
in
Yahweh, of
course. In any pagan temple, in the Hebrew temple, it doesn't matter what we're talking about, paganism or true Hebrewism or Christianity. That's the function of a priest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, we have instructions in the New Testament okay?
Yes.
Those instructions given to us in the New Testament are the will of the God,
mm-hmm.
Joshua Christ.
Right.
Okay? We're all priests. We're told to love one another, to take care of one another, to look out for one another. These things that we do are a function of our role as Christians.
Right, right.
We're all priests.
Yeah, and I
agree. In other words, there is no legitimate professional priesthood.
Not a professional priesthood outside of what I would call the king priest, the male head of household.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
it. There's no other professional priesthood.
Right. And so
profession,
in other words, By the way,
profession, the high priest of our profession,
yes.
in Hebrews 3:1, don't let anybody get that confused. Profession there is that which we profess.
Right.
It's not a professional priesthood.
Like a professor at a college.
Right.
Right.
Or a businessman or a
yeah.
an organization of professionals. No, the word homologia means like speaking.
Okay.
That's profession there.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Pastor Greg, do you understand Paul to be saying the same thing here?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, isn't it true that in the early days of Christianity, that what we had was family groups and communities who selected their own bishops? They didn't send their sons to seminaries. Their sons grew up in a family atmosphere, and the various king priests of the neighborhood, of the community, which were Israelite men who had studied the scriptures, those are the people who selected the bishop, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that the history of the early church, Bill?
Absolutely. I wrote at length on it in Clifton's teaching letters.
Right, right.
A paper called Misconceptions Concerning Paul and the Church, and it gives the entire model of the so-called church,
right,
as being the community, the ecclesia of each community, and the community rules itself.
Mm-hmm.
And ministers are a minister is a servant, a bishop is an episcopus, and that's actually where the word came from, is an overseer or a supervisor.
Okay.
All of these people are elected by the male members of the community.
Right, by their peers, essentially.
They choose their own leaders.
Right, right. Now, isn't it true that in the book of Revelation, I forget which, there's two churches that John, the revelator, has a problem with in terms of their relationship with the Nicolaitanes. Now, isn't the Nicolaitane a form of this seminarian-type priesthood?
Okay, let me talk about this for a minute.
Okay.
Nicolaitan comes
okay.
from two Greek words. There was never in history. We have no historical people called Nicolaitans.
Okay.
It's
so what's it describing?
You won't find any sect named Nicolaitans anywhere.
Okay.
Nikos means conquer.
Okay.
And Laitans is from the Greek word laos, meaning people.
Okay.
And the Nicolaitans are the people conquerors.
Right.
Which would be professional priests.
Right.
That control people through their espousal of sacramentalism.
Okay, okay.
And telling people, you have to give me tits.
Right.
You have to do this. You have to do that.
Yes.
If you don't do this, you're not saved.
Right.
You're going to hell.
That's right.
If
that's
you
right.
give us $50, we'll get your mother out of purgatory this month.
Yeah, well, that doesn't sound just like the Judaizers only. It describes the Catholic Church, too.
Oh, well, the pagan Roman Church, when Constantine legalized the Christian religion,
mm-hmm.
that's all he did was he decriminalized it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's all he did. He didn't make it the official religion of the empire. He only
right.
decriminalized it.
Right.
Okay? And
understood. Yes.
For a short time, the people, the real Christians, the Christians that risked their necks in the catacombs and in the back rooms
right.
to get together and have gatherings and practice their religion,
right.
for a very short time, they came out in the open and continued their religion, but it wasn't long at all before the politicians and all of the, for want of a better word, scum,
mm-hmm.
from the scum rises to the top all the time.
Right.
From the
in a corrupt house, yes.
changed their religion to Christianity, but kept their same temples, their same practices, their same business.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time of Justinian,
right,
that was all decreed, that they would be that the Roman Pope, the Roman Papa,
yeah,
but and all of his henchmen would basically run
right.
the Christian world.
Yeah, well let me address this question to Pastor Greg. Wouldn't it be the case then, Ken, that if you have a sacrificial priesthood, that the people are obviously dependent upon that priesthood to officiate the sacrifices, and that would tend to diminish the role of the congregation or ecclesia itself, and thereby force them to rely on this the separate priesthood. And do you see that this one of the reasons why that's been abolished?
Well, I don't know.
Well, obviously that ritual function has been abolished. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, and obviously the Levites were the ones who administered that.
Right.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't abuse it as much as when they were practicing Yahweh's version of it, but a lot of them practiced a paganized version of it, not only in the house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, but also in the house of Judah. The 2 Kings, 1 Kings, and Chronicles, convey this information to us. So aren't we talking here now, in terms of our people, a kind of democracy or republic of the priesthood?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what's being gotten at here. Let me jump to verse 7. I'll direct this to you, Ken. Now we are this house of God, if we will only hold on, confident and proud of our hope. Now, what's this word "we" referred to?
Well, of course, the house of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The 12 tribes, obviously,
yes.
Because
yes.
It never has changed.
Now, can that include anybody else but Israel?
No.
No. I agree. I think you're absolutely right about that. So, Bill, what have you got to say about verse 7 here?
Well, this whole thing is being addressed to Israel. This is all referring back to the Old Testament and the rebellion in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul is using that as a model for the rebellion of the Judahites under their Edomite leaders.
Uh-huh.
At the time of Christ in Palestine in the first century.
Okay, so he's making a direct comparison when the Israelites wandering through the desert under Moses rebelled against Moses and tried to institute their own law and create their own priesthood.
Right. The King James mistranslates a few words here. They call, rebellion here is from a Greek word that Paul uses, and it's really a Hebrewism.
Okay.
Okay. Parapikrasmos. It comes from a Greek word meaning to make bitter or to rebel. And Paul's using that word in a manner that it is not used in Greek secular literature.
I see. Okay.
But the Hebrew word mara, which basically means bitter.
Okay.
Means metaphorically to rebel,
yeah.
Or a rebel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
So Paul is using parapikrasmos in that manner. It's a Hebraism. And there are other Hebraisms in Paul's Greek.
Yes.
We have to be identified carefully because we don't want to take anything out of context.
Right, right. So in some cases, even when discussing the Greek, you have to refer back to the original Hebrew because idiomatically, the Israelites of Christ's time used idiomatic Hebrew expressions and tried to transliterate them into the Greek. Isn't that true? That there's a lot of expressions like that simply don't exist in the original Greek, but they try to convey them in the Greek from a Hebrew idiom.
Right, and Mark is replete with them. Mark has quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not just you have to know both the Greek and the Hebrew, and in many cases defer, as you say, you call it a Hebrewism, which would be an idiomatic restatement of a Hebrew expression. Okay.
Right. You have to understand some the Hebrew idioms. yes. used in the Bible.
Right. Okay.
The word Eve in Greek is pronounced completely different, isn't it, Bill?
Eve?
Yeah, that's because the V, as we know it, probably didn't exist in Greek. We get the V from the U.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of debate over the V and the letter U. In Hebrew, you'll see in Strong's Concordance, if you look at the alphabet, that the W letter is also a Vav. And that's the V-U correlation there.
Mm-hmm.
And in Rome, of course, it's debated today whether or not Veni, Vidi, Vici was really Veni, Vidi, Vici, or Veni, Vidi, Vici.
Right. The letter V, just like the letter J, was introduced later. And the letter J wasn't introduced until, the 1500s or 1600s. And there was only I, which counted for both as a Y sound and I, and maybe perhaps as a long I sound as well. But later substituted with the word Y, with the letter Y to substitute for the, consonantal sound of the letter I, correct? Isn't that the...
Yeah, it was originally a Y changed to an I, changed to a J.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very few names in the Hebrew and as we read them in English are actually anything like the Hebrew or the Greek word.
Right, right. Okay. Now, this brings up an interesting point. It's a side issue, but it's something that's been used against Josephus as recounting the Tetragrammaton, YHWH, where Josephus says the name of God is four vowels. And everybody in the world knows that there were no vowels necessarily in the Hebrew, at least they weren't written down.
Well, I just love these clowns because they don't realize the basic simple fact that when Josephus wrote that, he was writing in Greek.
Yeah, okay. He was.
So he had to mean four Greek vowels.
Okay, so he was referring to a Greek language. He wasn't referring to the Hebrew.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He said it was four vowels in Greek. He mm-hmm. was writing in Greek.
Right.
So he must have meant Greek.
So in other words, the four consonants of the Hebrew Yahweh, YHWH, are transliterated into four vowels in Greek? Is that what he's saying?
Absolutely, because they're consonantal vowels, those Hebrew
vowels. Oh, I see what you mean. Right, yeah, they have double usage.
Okay, they do. They all do.
So but Josephus was not lying.
He wasn't lying. He was writing in Greek, and he said that the name is pronounced
right.
with four vowels.
So those who criticized Josephus for apparently contradicting the Hebrew language
are missing the obvious.
Yeah, they simply don't know what they're talking about, and it's a case of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Absolutely. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing all the time.
Yeah, that's right. So they got
four vowels. The four vowels have to be either iota,
uh-huh.
alpha, upsilon, eta,
okay.
or iota, alpha, upsilon, alpha, or
right.
whatever. However you want
right.
to make Yahweh,
yeah.
the upsilon would be pronounced with when a U begins a syllable, it's pronounced like a W.
Yes, okay.
The same way that when a Y begins a syllable, and it's followed by a vowel, it's pronounced like an I. It's pronounced like a Y.
Right.
Okay.
As in, and in French, we have that situation today, like their word for yes is oui, and it's three vowels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And look at, like, my name, William, there's no W in Greek.
Right.
So if I wanted to spell it in Greek, I'd have to begin it with a U.
Okay. Right, yeah.
William.
Right, right.
And the result would be the same.
Right, right.
But, Yahweh is four vowels, and right. those four vowels are basically the same, three of the four vowels are the same three Roman letters as the name Jove.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman high god Jove, who was Yahweh.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I can debate this, willing to debate this with anybody, but the origin of the Roman high god Jove the father, Pater Jove, Jove Pater
yes.
is Jupiter.
Yes.
That's where they got Jupiter from. It's a contraction of Jove, Yahweh,
yeah,
and
which is
Pater.
A version of Yahweh, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So, you know, unless you know these connections between the ancient languages, you
and
simply don't understand.
People.
Yeah.
And the ancient people.
Right, right.
Because the Romans are Trojans who came from Zarajuda.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, in other words, the word Jove actually comes from the word Yahweh.
And it's the same four vowels, except that possibly the epsilon at the end, the E,
mm-hmm.
was an eta.
Okay.
It's possible. That's the way I envision it.
So Yova, right. And there were very...
Yahweh.
Yeah, right, exactly. So
right.
we find that the so-called pagan god Jove is actually a reference to Yahweh, and very few people understand that.
Well, Paul tells the Romans in Romans chapter 1 that they took the truth, and he's talking to Romans. He's
yes.
talking to uncircumcised Romans, there's no doubt.
Yes.
They had the truth of God, of
mm-hmm.
Yahweh, and changed it into a lie.
Yes. Outstanding. All right, let me go to verses 7 through 10 here. Now, in this Moffat translation, these are italicized, but I think what he wants to do here is... use the italics as a quote, not to say that this doesn't exist in the original text. So I think that's why he's italicized it here. And he says, today, let me finish the thought here of verse 7 and continue. Now we are this house of God if we will only hold on confident and proud of our hope. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today when you hear his voice, harden not your hearts as at the provocation, and that's the direct reference back to the Israelites rebelling back in the days of Moses, on the day of the temptation in the desert, where he makes it very clear, the temptation in the desert, where your fathers put me to the proof. And what's being said here, Pastor Greg, isn't that saying that our ancestors put Yahweh to the test?
Right. And now mine reads, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion
mm-hmm.
in the day of the trial in the wilderness.
Yes. Okay.
Where your fathers tried me.
Yeah. So I think that translation is even better because that's a direct reference to the 12 tribes wandering through the wilderness.
Right.
And you can't get that wrong.
Right. And see, these Edomites admitted right there in John 8 that they'd never been in bondage to anybody. Who was in bondage 400 years down there in Egypt?
Right. Exactly. And so we put Yahweh to the test by creating these false gods, these Baal gods, etc. And the Israelites, and so obviously, now he says, your fathers. He's talking about the ancestors of the Hebrews, correct?
Right,
yes.
But we'll get into that in a second because it wasn't that their fathers, I have to jump ahead to my notes at verse 10.
Okay.
It wasn't that their fathers necessarily were the ones that were the authors of
mm-hmm.
of that rebellion.
Right.
Which that word provocation should be translated rebellion. That's the parapikrasmos that I was talking about.
Okay,
before.
So Pastor Greg's version is correct in using that term.
Right.
Okay, all right.
Not because the race itself was rebellious and no good,
mm-hmm.
for if that were the case, none of them would have survived to have offspring, which could be reading Paul's epistle.
Right, right.
Rather, because their fathers indeed followed the rebellious ones,
yes.
the actual leaders of the rebellion were ultimately destroyed the desert, and that's
right.
the point of verse 3:17.
Yes, okay. Well, in spite of all that, you know, just our children have been, our people have been rebelling constantly throughout the ages, you know.
Right.
I was going to say.
Direct line,
mm-hmm.
and he's following one group of people, one single group of people through
right.
the Old Testament into Christianity,
right.
because
yeah.
Christianity is only for that group of people.
Right. And obviously, you know, the Israelites followed Moses for 40 years and created the kingdom of Israel, and therefore those who did not rebel obviously survived to create the kingdom at that time.
Right.
Yeah, so
isn't that what they're doing today, though?
That's right.
The church today is in rebellion because they're following these rebellious Baal priests right into the pig's sty.
Yes, right. Yeah. And one of the people in the chat room says the book of Hebrews has a great emphasis on faith. And I don't know if we'll get to it in chapter 3, but faith includes the practice of the law. And
right.
the administration of the law by the proper priesthood. And I think this is, you know, this is the reason I wanted to discuss the book of Hebrews, is what is the proper priesthood? So let me continue here. Where your fathers put me to the proof, and for 40 years felt what I could do. Okay, so it's an obvious reference to the 40 years in the wilderness. Therefore, I grew exasperated with that generation. I said, they are always astray in their heart, and indeed we are today. They would not learn my ways. So I swore in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. Okay, now, he's talking about certain members of that generation, correct? Or is he talking about all the members of that generation? Even though they built a kingdom, they did not enter his rest. Either of you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the actual Greek says, so I have sworn in my wrath whether they should enter into
my rest. Whether, okay.
It never says no.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't, the King James translators, they said they shall not enter into my rest.
Mm-hmm.
Greek word is EI, and it means if or whether.
Yes.
And
okay.
And it's pretty ambiguous how it's being used here, and I translate
right.
it whether because I want to keep my translation literal.
Right, right.
And not read what I think it says into the translation.
Right, right.
But my translation says if they shall enter into my rest.
Okay.
They
right.
did
so,
the same thing I did, but they chose if instead of whether.
Okay,
in
right.
other words, that's also a good literal translation.
Right. So so Moffat agrees more with the King James here, and your two translations agree with each other. So it sounds like it should be if or whether,
right.
rather than
or a if or whether. There's no negative. There's no definite negative
mm-hmm.
intonation in the word.
Right.
There's no. You can't attribute that meaning to the word.
Right. Now, what do you think the word rest here implies?
Paul explains later on that a day of rest is promised to the children of Israel.
Okay.
That a period of rest.
Okay.
And that would have to imply the next age, the next peaceful age where there's
mm-hmm.
nobody but Adamites.
Right.
So just nothing but peace.
Well, what about the possibility that it might be a reference to, you know, once they finally defeated the Canaanites and established their own kingdom, they had a golden age
right.
under David and Solomon.
And that's only a model of the things to come.
Okay.
And that's why Paul is using this as a model of
okay.
the salvation in Christ.
So it can have both meanings or either or.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Okay. Is that how you understand it, Ken?
Yes.
That we're talking about. And obviously, rest, I forget what verse it is, that we shall no more be afflicted by the children of wickedness.
Right.
And that would imply a period of rest, too, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's what's coming.
That's right. That's what's coming. Okay.
That's the promise of the second advent.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Exactly. The children of wickedness will no more afflict us. Praise Yahweh. Hallelujah.
And you'll see
the
Lord
sure ain't happy.
And I in the house of the Lord.
That's right. Exactly.
Right.
Okay. So let me continue here. This is good stuff. Brothers, take care lest there be a wicked, unbelieving heart in any of you, moving you to be apostates from the living God. Rather, admonish one another daily, so long as this word today is uttered, that none of you may be deceived by sin and hardened. Okay, now he uses the word sin here, and you know, those who say that Paul doesn't believe in sin because he teaches against the law, well, why would he be invoking the concept of sin if there is no law?
Right.
Well, because Paul doesn't teach those things.
That's right.
Right, right. I don't know how they can read Paul's writings and believe that he doesn't teach the law.
Yeah.
I mean, even the King James teaches that he's saying the law.
Yes, yes. And so what we have is selective editing. Isn't that what these people actually do? Now, I don't want to, you know, say the anti-Paulians within the Christian identity movement, but certainly the universalizers of Paul, what they actually do is they selectively edit those verses that imply that he teaches against the law, but they will not teach at all. They will leave out of their commentaries these verses that say he does believe in the law, he does believe in punishment, he does believe that there will be a judgment day, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, there's so many things that they leave out.
Mm-hmm.
They just read parts of things.
That's right.
I've had people in my home numerous times, and I'll take their Bible and read things to them, and they say, "Where does it say that?" And I say, "Is this your Bible?"
Yeah, right.
Yes. Your preacher hasn't taught you from this?
Right.
Why not?
Right, right.
What's he hiding, you know?
Exactly, exactly. What are they hiding? That's got to be...
They take advantage of the ignorance of the people, and they set up for themselves an air of authority that
yes.
makes it difficult for them to be questioned.
Just like the Nico, just like the Nicolaitans?
Absolutely. That's
yes.
what they are.
Yeah.
They're the people conquerors, the professional priesthood, the professional ministers
yeah.
of Protestantism today, and the professional clergy of the Catholic Church.
That's right. And the Jewish rabbis.
And those same ones today are called TV evangelists.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the wolves
yeah.
in sheep's clothing. There are, so we can compare the wolves in sheep's clothing we have today with the Nicolaitans in the book of Revelation, right?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Verse 14, for we only, now this sounds very exclusive, we only participate in Christ, provided that we hold firm to the very end the confidence with which we started, this word ever sounding in our ears. Today, when you hear his voice, harden not your hearts as at the provocation. In other words, isn't he saying here, we should not rebel as the Israelites rebelled in the wilderness?
That's the translation I've got, rebellion.
Okay, why don't you read your verses 14 and 15 from your translation there?
For we have become partakers of Messiah if we hold fast the beginning of our trust firm to the end,
mm-hmm.
while it is said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion.
Okay, now, he's talking about a rebellion. Wasn't that a rebellion against the law of Moses?
Yes.
Bill, is there any other way to interpret this?
The whole point Paul is trying to make here is that a disbelief in Christ is a rebellion from the law and the prophets.
Okay. All right. All right. So the antinomians and universalists have got this all wrong, don't they?
Absolutely.
Well,
and see, you're using the word belief, and the person that mentioned the faith chapter, which is Hebrews 11,
mm-hmm.
the word is not faith, but it's belief.
Okay.
And by belief, each time. And what was the belief?
Right. Well, now, let me just put out a general question, because the modern Judeo-Christian clergy interprets the word belief or faith to mean basically any old faith or any old belief that all you have to do is believe in Jesus. But you have to have the right Jesus to believe in.
Absolutely. Everybody believes in their own idea of Jesus.
Right, right. And if you got the wrong idea of Jesus, you got the wrong faith.
And that's 99% of them.
That's right. That's right. Otherwise, the whole world wouldn't have been deceived, would it?
Right.
Yeah, so what we're getting here is Paul is comparing their lack of faith, or the probability or the possibility that they might lose their faith, to the rebellion back in the wilderness. So be careful. Don't lose that. And so also faith, therefore, would also have to be including the concept of the law, in the sense that, let me see if I can articulate this properly, you have to have faith in the teachings given to by the Moses and the prophets. And if you don't have faith in that, and you're not practicing that, there's no demonstration of Yahweh's rewards for following that. Do you follow what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Was that clear?
Yeah. Well, when you get into verses 17 and 18, it's talking about they sinned and would not enter in
mm-hmm.
Because they didn't obey.
Right. So maybe I can put it a little better. The curses in Deuteronomy 28 and the blessings of Deuteronomy 28, and those are all based on Yahweh's law. If you don't
right.
have faith that the operation of those laws will result in curses and blessings, depending on whether you follow them or not, then you don't have faith, right?
Yeah.
And they're all aimed at the nation
right.
more than the individual.
Right, right. Because there's their national message that, of course, the modern churches don't teach either. They don't teach that the nation of Israel has to come together to practice this faith to obey his law.
Well, it's like I said, it comes back to belief. It's like I asked some people one day, do you believe? I read a verse, and I don't remember which one it was. Let's use the word Sabbath. Do you believe that he said not to work on the Sabbath day, but to rest?
Yes.
They said, yes. I said, no, you don't. Because if you did believe it, you would obey what it says.
That's right.
So that tells me you don't believe it.
I believe it, but I don't practice it.
Right.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And so, which means what? You're not really believing it, are you?
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's the test. And as somebody, James 2:17, even so, faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone. So what's your belief worth if you're not doing anything with it? It's
right.
Worth nothing.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what, you know, both James and Paul are trying to get across. It's not that Paul is denying the effectiveness of the law. He's saying, well, you have to be faithful to it in order for Yahweh to demonstrate to you that he's going to deliver the goods.
Yeah.
And if you're not practicing it, there's no goods to be delivered except the curses.
Well, it's like Deuteronomy 28, which Leviticus 26 is a sister chapter to. There's 68 verses in Deuteronomy 28. The first 14 verses are blessings. The next 54 verses are cursings.
Yes.
Why does the cursings outweigh the blessings?
Right.
Because we're a rebellious, stubborn, stiff-necked people.
That's right. That's
and
right.
If you read those curses, we've already undergone most of them.
That's right.
Oh, the answer in our nation has just risen above us the last election day.
Right. Our whole nation is suffering all those curses in Deuteronomy 28, without
and
a doubt.
It's the culmination of this punishment because of our own apostasy.
That's right.
And,
yes.
And do these people think it is apostasy?
No, they don't think it's apostasy. They're all self-righteous.
They think they're practicing the faith, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is the church of the Laodiceans, the self-righteous people.
That's right. The last church of the last age. Exactly.
Well, even these people today that they say they never thought that they would see the day that a black would be elected president of the United States.
Right.
Now are turning around saying, well, I hope he can make a change in things. Well, what are they doing?
Yes.
They're taking their faith away from Yahweh and giving it to a mongrel nigger.
Well, isn't that a violation of the first commandment?
Yes.
Yeah.
The only change we need is change back.
Wait, hold on. Okay, Bill, go ahead.
The only change we need is change back.
Right, to
yes.
God's law. Right.
We have to get rid of all this back.
Not to the rituals and the sacrifices.
Upstairs.
Yeah. But to the true faith, which is obedience. Okay, let's go on here. Verses 16. I'll just go through 16 through 19, which takes us to the end of Hebrews chapter 3. Let me back up. Today, when you hear his voice, harden not your hearts as at the provocation. Who heard and yet provoked him? Was it not all who left Egypt under the leadership of Moses? So here he's, you know, implicating all the Israelites. Just for having the thought, you know, of rebelling against Yahweh. And with whom was he exasperated for 40 years? It was us, Israelites. Can any other people besides Israel be implicated in this statement?
No.
No. He's talking about our experience, the experience of our ancestors' post-Exodus experience. No other people had this experience except Israel.
Right.
Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the desert? And to whom did he swear that they would never enter his rest? Those who sinned, right?
Right.
Now, to whom does this word sin apply most?
Israel.
Israel. Because why? We were given the law.
Yes.
Nobody else was given the law.
Look at what even happened in Egypt when he put those plagues on. It happened to all the other people,
yes,
but not to the Israelites.
Right. And they
None
still don't believe.
Have Israelites.
Yeah. They still don't have faith.
Right.
Even after
seeing that.
Even after that kind of demonstration, how easily our people forget when we have that kind of demonstration and don't pay attention to it. Bill, is that how you see these verses?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So he's talking to our ancestors who, despite these demonstrations, still fail to believe.
Well, they had the pillar of smoke and the pillar of fire before them.
Yeah. I mean,
they saw the sea open. They saw the powerful armies of the Pharaoh that they managed to escape from.
Yeah. The waters parted. They escaped, and the Egyptians didn't.
And they were still disbelieving.
Yes. And so then Paul continues to say here, so to whom but those who disobeyed? Who's Yahweh upset with? He's upset with these disobedient Israelites. Go ahead.
One has to note that it wasn't a totally pure Israel that came out.
That's true, yes.
They had a mingled multitude with them.
Yeah, there was a mixed multitude that accompanied them, right.
They had slaves, basically.
Right, right. Yes, and there were possibly scribes. There were certainly Egyptians. Now, not all of the Egyptians were non-Adamic.
Right.
The vast majority of Egyptians, certainly the leadership, was Hamitic, which were the brothers of the Shemites, of the Hebrews.
Right.
Okay.
And but you can prove that with when his brothers came in to see Joseph, they thought he was an Egyptian.
Right, because he was dressed differently from them.
Yes, but his skin color had to have been the same color as Egyptians.
Well, yeah,
if they were black and he was white, they would have known he wasn't an Egyptian.
Right, but also being in a much hotter climate, he would have gotten a suntan, wouldn't he?
Sure.
Well, if you look at the archaeology of Egypt, all the early dynasties and their artwork, they're clearly white people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's
right.
No doubt. I have seen Egyptian death masks, Egyptian portraits of people that are buried in their tombs.
Yes.
That have blue eyes.
Right, and red hair.
Hair
and blonde hair.
Blue eyes.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that they're not.
That they're white. There's no doubt that they're white, yeah. Yeah.
Josephus says that Thutmose is the pharaoh that oppressed the Israelites.
Okay.
Now, there were four pharaohs named Thutmose.
Ah, okay.
And that leads me into the name Moses real quick.
Okay.
You know, the pharaoh, the last pharaoh of the 17th dynasty, his name was Ahmoses.
Okay.
And the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty was Khamoses.
All right.
And then you had Thutmose I, Thutmose II.
Mm-hmm.
Thutmose III, and the daughter of the pharaoh called him Moses because she took him out of the water.
Uh-huh.
She gave him her family name.
Right, right.
Moses, Ka Moses, Thutmose.
Right.
Moses. She gave him her family name. That's why he's named Moses.
Right, right.
All of the Hebrew commentators say, oh, Moses must mean something to do with drawing water.
Okay.
Well, that's some crap.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, it's not a Hebrew word, is it? Moses is
not? No, absolutely not.
Okay.
And it's obviously the name of that entire line of pharaohs.
Right. Now, it's very interesting.
Moses III took a Hittite wife.
Ah.
And okay. Thutmose IV was the offspring of this wife. I mean, he had other wives.
Okay.
And there was competition for the throne when Thutmose III died.
So that's where the bad blood came in, a Hittite wife.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very plausible that Thutmose IV was the
right.
pharaoh who oppressed the Israelites.
And if he was part Hittite, which means Canaanite, that would explain why the Israelites did not get along with that administration.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Another pharaoh was raised up that didn't know Joseph.
Right. He did not know Joseph. Yes.
That wanted to oppress the Israelites, and
yes.
he was a Hittite. Well, why wouldn't he oppress the Israelites?
Yes, because the Hittites, the Canaanites, hated the Israelites. They've been our worst enemies throughout history.
In Clifton Emmaheiser's early teaching letters, he goes into the whole Thutmose thing in good length, and I forget the numbers. It's around the 20s or the 30s.
Okay. Early stuff.
Maybe
okay.
7-8 years ago he did this. But, yeah, he went into this at great length and documented everything that I just explained.
Yeah. Now, isn't it true when Joseph first wound up in Egypt that it wasn't Pharaoh's wife, it was a lesser official's wife that he was staying with. Didn't she try to seduce Joseph?
Yes.
Yeah, Pastor Greg, how do you understand that passage? Obviously, Joseph was not just, you know, because he didn't appreciate her feminine charms, but didn't Joseph say, I can't do this against the law?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So he was obviously following Yahweh's law when he refused the advances of this woman.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, is there any indication that this woman was one of these Canaanites? But from what you're saying, Bill, that was too early. The Canaanites did not have influence in Egypt yet.
Well, that's not entirely true, because the Levant was for a great deal of this time,
mm-hmm,
subject to Egypt.
Oh, okay.
Well,
so the whole
around.
Yeah, the whole of Palestine, in other words.
Right.
Yeah.
They probably went around.
It was always a struggle. There was always a struggle between the Mitanni kingdom to the north and the Egyptians to the south and
okay.
the Hittites over who was going to control
right.
the Levant.
Okay. So, Pastor Greg, you were trying to say something there?
I was just saying that they've been around as long as cockroaches.
Oh, right. That's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Their merchants get into everywhere and have influence everywhere, and
right.
they always have had.
Yeah. And that's and certainly even in Egypt and in Assyria and Babylon and every place else, because all of these kingdoms were actually founded by Adamic people. And unfortunately, these Adamic kingdoms I have to say proto-Jewish bankers, okay, and advisors, because they had the money, and they would often borrow money from these Canaanites and these scribes that they hired, which were not of the same racial stock, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, in other words, the enemy has always been with us in that sense, and doesn't that take us right back to Genesis 3:15? Where it states that the enemy would, nip at our heels until we stomp on their head.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So,
there's
in other
no
words,
getting rid of them until it's the will of Yahweh to get
right.
rid of.
So, aren't we talking about what we call today the Jewish state within a state?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That now, at the time of Moses, the Babylonian Empire had control of the Levant.
Okay.
And the Babylonian Empire was the empire of the Cushites.
That's right. Okay.
That's why Moses went to Cush to take a wife.
Uh-huh.
He went to the land of Cush.
Right.
That, all of Saudi Arabia and the Levant and all that, was considered the land of Cush by the Hebrews,
mm-hmm,
because it was what we know as the Babylonian Empire
right.
by the archaeologists.
Right, right. But Cush goes back to the kingdoms of Ham, Shem, and Japheth.
Cush goes back to the kingdom of Nimrod, set up the first empire. And if you look in Genesis chapter 10, Nimrod was a son or a grandson of Cush.
Cush, right.
Yeah, I think he was a son of Cush.
Right.
So why wouldn't his empire be called the Cush, the empire of Cush?
Right. And there was a Cush in the east near India. As I understand it.
Well,
and then
it extended from Arabia all the way to India. It
okay.
extended that far at one time.
Right, right. And even toward Egypt, right? And then it split up. And so there's an Egyptian Kush and there's an Indian Kush, correct?
Well, the Egyptian Kush isn't Egyptian. Actually, Ethiopia was actually founded by Kushites who went there through the Persian Gulf.
Okay.
By
Adamic people.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
They were absolutely white, the first
Ethiopia. So Ethiopia was an Adamic nation when it was founded.
We have two Cushes in the Hebrew. We
yes.
have the rivers of Cush in Genesis chapter 1. That's not in Ethiopia south of Egypt.
Right.
That is the Cush of the east.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And we have two Cushes in the Hebrew Bible, the Cush south of Egypt, that's yeah. Ethiopia, and the Cush in the east. And the Greeks had, in the early Greek writings, two Ethiopias.
Mm-hmm.
Herodotus talks about the Ethiopia south of Egypt,
yeah.
which the Hebrews called Cush.
Right.
And Herodotus talks about the Ethiopians of the east.
Yeah.
Which the Hebrews called Cush.
Right, right.
And the obvious resolution for this, because the Greeks had two Ethiopias that happened to match these two Hebrew Cushes,
right?
is that Nimrod's empire was called Cush by the Hebrews.
Yes.
And the later Greeks referred back to that as Ethiopia.
Uh-huh.
And Memnon in Hesiod, who was a writer 200 years before Herodotus,
right.
Hesiod wrote that Memnon, the Ethiopian,
mm-hmm.
founded the city of Susa.
Okay.
Well, Susa was the capital city of Persia.
Right, right.
That wasn't an African that was there.
yeah. Well, the Persians were lily white, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. They were known to be lily white.
I actually just sent you information on that. In
okay.
email.
I haven't looked at that yet, but
okay.
Then the word blue blood, as I understand it, actually goes all the way back to Egypt. Because it was the white pharaohs and the white kings and queens of Egypt could see their blue veins sticking through their white skin. Isn't that where the word blue blood originates?
Well, I wouldn't doubt it, but I don't know that.
Oh, okay. But still, it's true that you can see in white people today. That's still evident.
You don't see that in blacks.
Yes. That's hard. In fact, I was recently at the VA hospital giving a blood sample. And virtually all the nurses there are black, you know. And the black nurse had no trouble finding my veins. But there was a black guy in the stall next to me. And the nurse just had a hell of a time finding his vein. And the guy screaming in pain, no, no, you got to, you know, try again. you know, so it's obvious. We can find our, it's easier to find the veins of a white man, you know, because our blue blood sticks out through the veins.
You know, the King James has substituted that word Ethiopian
uh-huh.
for obvious reasons. And I have a book somewhere that is 1949, I think, is published in Tennessee.
Okay.
And it talked that the Ethiopians were white people.
Right.
In 1949.
Yes.
And
they don't teach that. They try not to teach that today, do they?
No.
Yeah.
It's not politically correct.
Yeah. All these things started changing about 1950.
Right. But as Bill said earlier, if you look at the mummies that go back to those days, there's absolutely no doubt that those mummies, in fact, that the color of their hair, the mummification process preserved the color of their hair, which is often blonde or red, okay? And it could be brunette as well. But their skin is preserved as well, and their skin is clearly white. And their features are Nordic.
Right. Now, here's another thing. You know, people just don't think for themselves. You know,
yes.
In Numbers, Yahweh told Moses that no bastard can enter into the congregation.
Right.
Well, if Moses married an Ethiopian, which today's a black woman,
mm-hmm.
then his own children wouldn't even have been
right.
allowed into the congregation.
Right. Well, actually, I looked that passage up in the book of Jasher because somebody, there's debate as to whether that Ethiopian woman was fully white or not. But the book of Jasher says that Moses did not consummate the marriage to the Ethiopian woman. In other words, he never had sex with her. Therefore, there were no offspring, and he never disobeyed the law. So whether
I have to intervene here.
Okay, go ahead.
It's very, a lot of parts, I can prove that much of the book of Jasher was added
okay.
much later.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And there's even, if you read the last chapters of the book of Jasher, I mean, I believe that the core of Jasher is actually a legitimate book at one time.
Yes, okay.
Okay? But if you read the last chapter, and I've read the entire book of Jasher, and if you read the last chapters of it, you'll find references to Caesar's conquering Britain,
oh.
which are made to look as if they happened at the same time that Moses was leading the Israelites out of Egypt.
So that's obviously added later.
and many other parts of Jasher
right.
were added
okay.
later.
Okay, but in either case, whether it was whether it's historically accurate or not, if she was, let me put it this way, if she was a non-white Ethiopian, Moses did not have sex with her. And
I went into the story about Moses and going to Cush, but I didn't really have the opportunity to finish it.
Okay.
If you actually read through Exodus, you'll find that he went to the land of Cush,
mm-hmm.
which was actually the Mesopotamian
right.
Cush.
Mesopotamian
not Cush below Egypt.
Right. And so
and
people,
the
right.
woman that he married, even though he met her in the land called Cush,
right.
because the Cushites had ruled over that area of Arabia at the time,
right.
she was a Midianite.
Right, exactly. That's what I was just going to say. She was a Midianite.
But she was a Midianite. She was a descendant of Abraham's son, Midian, by Keturah,
mm-hmm.
who was actually sent, his descendants were sent to the East Country.
Right.
Which would be to Cush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would be the Cushite Empire at that time, the Mesopotamian one,
right.
and not the African one.
Right.
So there's no African connection with Moses' wife whatsoever.
Okay, so the Midianite woman was a legitimate wife, did not violate Deuteronomy 23:2 in any way, because she was a legitimate Adamite woman.
Absolutely.
Right. And her father was a Midianite priest.
Right, right. Now, isn't it true? Because we have to be historically accurate, because people are going to say, didn't we have war against the Midianite people, like we had war against the Ammonites and the Moabites? Well, the answer for that is yes, but that occurred later.
And they had mingled with the Moabites.
Right.
By that time.
Right, right. So, but
and,
that,
and,
go ahead.
It may well be that there were different pockets of Midianites in different places.
Yes.
Just like there were different pockets of Hebrews. Everybody thinks that the Israelites are Hebrew. Well, they are, but they're not the only Hebrews.
Right. Yeah.
I have tons of inscriptions, Assyrian inscriptions, that show that there were Hebrews in Mesopotamia, in northern Mesopotamia, that support all the stories about Abraham and
yeah.
Jacob and Isaac going north
right.
for a wife to Padan Aram.
Right. Well, we have Hebrew inscriptions in New Mexico.
Well,
the
yeah.
Ten Commandments
well,
in Hebrew.
Right out.
Yes.
And the Midianites that Moses took a wife from aren't necessarily the same Midianites.
Yeah.
That were destroyed, that had mixed with the Moabites and were destroyed later by the children
right.
of Israel.
Okay, Pastor Greg, you were going to say something here.
Yeah, you were talking about the inscriptions in New Mexico. In Tennessee, in the Great Lakes area, all over the United States, they've got all kinds of Hebrew inscriptions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that the ones in New Mexico are the Ten Commandments.
Right.
And they've been dated back to 2000 B.C.,
yeah, because it's in Paleo-Hebrew.
Right, in Paleo-Hebrew, which the Jews do not which the Jews
right.
do not use. And, by the way, the Paleo-Hebrew was, because the critics of this will say it's easy to, scribble something on a stone wall. But very, very few people ever have known about the Paleo-Hebrew and
right.
how that the Jewish Hebrew has substituted, for the Paleo-Hebrew. And there's other ancient scripts as well that nobody could have known about until recent scholarship has dug this stuff up,
Right. 70 A.D. is when this modern Hebrew,
right.
these Edomite Jews come out, and they actually speak Yiddish.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And Yiddish is mainly German. It's very unrelated to Hebrew at all. They put Hebrew characters to it, but it's German in origin. Okay. I think, we're conveying pretty well that this whole gospel is conveyed to the Adamic people and to no one else. And, of course, the Israelites being the main tribes, the main 12 tribes through which all of this history is carried through. And that's why the Bible is concerned exclusively, almost, certainly, from the Exodus on, with Israelites and not with any other people. Okay? So let me continue here. Let me just carry it to the end. And with whom was he exasperated for 40 years? Obviously Israel. Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the desert? And to whom did he swear that they would never enter his rest? Again, it sounds like he's being emphatic here, which shouldn't be. So let me go to the final verse. To whom but those who disobeyed? Thus we see it was owing to their unbelief that they could not enter. Okay, they could not enter the rest or the kingdom. All right, so Pastor Greg, we're approaching in. You want to have a final comment on these verses and, overall?
Well, obviously he's saying to those who did not obey. So, it's obvious that some of them weren't able to enter in, but some were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the older generation. And it probably goes back to the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. All right, Bill, you have a final word for us here on these verses and then overall on Hebrews chapter 3?
Yeah, I have a summarization here I'd like to make.
Okay.
Paul is taking the Old Testament as a model and presenting it to the Hebrews and explaining to them, Hebrew people that we know are Israelites.
Yes.
That it's very clear these people are Israelites.
Yes.
In this particular epistle
right.
that he's addressing.
Yes. Okay.
It's not questioned. Their history is known. There's mm-hmm. no hidden mysteries.
Now, let me just ask a general question at this point. Is it even conceivable that Paul was talking to non-Israelites or non-Hebrews about these issues who would have actually no personal knowledge or even historical knowledge of these things?
Well, the way he presents the Old Testament here is because they have a personal knowledge and a historical knowledge of these things.
Right. So he can't possibly be addressing anybody but Hebrews and Israelites, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
the point I'm going to make is that, likewise, Paul again and again cited the Old Testament, but in a totally different way to the Romans,
okay.
to the Corinthians, to the Ephesians, to the Colossians, because they're Israelites too.
Yes.
And that can all be proven from the things that Paul said to those people.
Right, right.
Like when he told the Corinthians, all our fathers were under the cloud.
Right.
And all
that's that rapture cloud. That's that rapture cloud, Bill.
Well, he told them clearly in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that they were all in this group that was led out of Egypt.
That's right. That's right. So there's no disputing. There's no possibility of getting this wrong unless you're willfully distorting what he's saying, right? And creating
absolutely.
And you've got an agenda which is totally anti-scriptural.
Well, in verse Hebrews 2:16, he says, "For doubtless he does not take hold of messengers, but he does take hold of the seed of Abraham."
Right. Right. Seed of Abraham. It can only mean the descendants of Abraham, right? Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Any more comments there from you, Bill? I don't know if we cut you off or not.
Oh, no. I just wanted to make that point. That
right.
When Paul takes the Old Testament and explains parts of it to the Romans and the Corinthians and the other people of the Oikoumene whom he presented the gospel to,
yes,
that he's making the same point, that these are your ancestors and this is why I'm telling you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I wouldn't be bother to tell you about all this if these weren't your ancestors.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're presenting tremendous evidence against the interpretation of Paul as universalizer, against the interpretation of him, you know, reaching out to all nations and races, or as an antinomian. None of that's true. Absolutely none of it is true. It's based on the little knowledge is a dangerous thing and a deliberate agenda by the universalizing Catholic Church. The word Catholic means universal. And these televangelists and other their followers who are doing everything they can to destroy the scriptures. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why the
King
Catholic
James.
Church forbid people from having Bibles for 1,000 years.
That's right. The Catholic Church forbade it. Now they just don't want us to read it. They sell us Bibles, but they won't let us read it.
They have to read it to you.
That's right.
One verse at a time.
So you only get their version, only their interpretation. Right. Absolutely right. All right, gentlemen, I thank you very much. I think this has been a very enlightening, and this is not easy stuff, folks. And one of the reasons why Paul is misinterpreted and misunderstood is because unless you have this historical knowledge, you cannot understand this stuff. If you know, Paul is not talking to 21st century Christians. Obviously, this is written down for us, but he's not talking to 20, and you cannot project a 21st century understanding and comprehension to those days.
What today's pastors should be doing is they should be gaining for themselves an understanding of the world in the first century, so that they could present scripture in its historical context.
That's right. It has to be understood in its historical context, and if you don't understand it that way, you are misunderstanding it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, I think we will pursue this line of argument for the rest of the book of Hebrews. I'm anxious to get into his descriptions of the priesthood of Melchizedek, which we are, which we Israelites are, and nobody else but Israelites can be. We'll get into that next week, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Yahweh bless everybody. And tomorrow at noon Eastern, I'll be on with my other show, The Voice of Christian Israel. I forget what the topic is going to be, but it should be a good show. All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Pastor Kirk. Okay.
Hallelujah. Praise Yahweh.
Okay. Praise Yahweh. Okay, and thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll do this again next Saturday night, and look forward to more preaching and teaching like you're not going to hear anywhere else. Yahweh bless. Yahweh bless everybody.